Hey, Renter Retires, it's Adam Schrader here with another episode, joined as usual by Zach Lee Master, the founder and CEO of Rent to Retirement. And we are joined today by Avery Carl. She is the CEO and founder of The Short Term Shop. So we're going to be talking some short term rentals. So Avery, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So we want to start off by hearing about the first deal that you did in real estate, but also I'd like to know just kind of why you picked short-term rentals, because, you know, a lot of investors, short-term is something that comes later down the road because they want to start with the simple long-term rentals. So why did you choose to focus on the short-term aspect?
That's a great question. So the very first deal I bought was a long-term rental, and it was actually a really, really good long-term rental. That was back in 2014, maybe. And we were living in Nashville at the time. We were going to all our local real estate meetups, and all these investors were saying, Nashville's over. You had to buy in Nashville in 2010 to make any money anymore. Everything, you know, basically saying it can't be done anymore. And so we were saving our pennies, not really knowing what we were doing. And we happened to find a deal right on the MLS, like the day it went on the market. It had no pictures, nothing. Happened to be listed by the seller's daughter, who had just gotten licensed, and she kind of didn't really quite know what she was doing yet. So
you know how to work a camera, apparently.
Yeah. So we happened to be, when it hit the MLS, like at the bar around the corner. So we just went and looked at it. We're like, man, this is in really good shape. And it was perfect. So we just offered full price and got the deal. And that deal, the mortgage on that was about $650 a month, and we were able to rent it for $1,500 a month at the time. Which also at the time, with a master's degree and several years of experience, I was working as a marketing manager in the music business. And that $1,000 a month after all of my deductions for my paycheck and everything was about the same as what I was making. So we went, oh crap, we need more of these. What can we buy next? Like, we only had one down payment for one single family left. It wasn't like we could go just buy a multifamily. And we said, well, what can we buy that's going to make us the most amount of money the fastest so we can buy more? And so we landed on short-term rentals. We did not want to do that in Nashville because the regulations are very anti, very volatile. But we'd just been on vacation to the Smoky Mountains, which is about 4 hours east of Nashville. And we'd stayed in a cabin there, and everybody else was staying in cabins there. And this was way before there was any kind of really education or data. There were no courses. There were no short-term rental gurus back then. There might have been one. And we said, well, somebody owns these cabins. Why can't it be us? And we found that we'd planned to put them with a property manager, but we found when we were researching that at the time, the average property management split for short-term rentals in the Smokies was 40% of your gross. And we said, well, wait a minute, that's not going to work because we're doing this so we can make enough to go buy more, and we need that 40%. So we figured out how to self-manage it remotely from Nashville. And to make a long story short, scaled one of those to 5 over the course of the next year and a half. That first one we bought at the end of 2015, and now we have 250 doors. 8 of them are short terms. The rest of them are single family, long terms, and multifamily. So for us, we bought the short terms at the beginning because they cash flowed a little heavier than our long terms so that we could build up the cash flow to get into those bigger deals.
And talk a little bit about that scaling, because you mentioned you only had enough for one more down payment. That kind of started it. And then you ended with, and then we went from 1 to 5 in, you know, a very short amount of time. I mean, that's a massive scale. So how did y'all manage to do that?
Great question. So a number of ways. So number one, I think where a lot of people, especially people that go on podcasts all the time, where the thing that they don't mention is really just buckling down. Nobody wants to hear this either. Everybody wants, you know, the magic combo. Just buckling down and budgeting ourselves to death. I had us on like a $20 a day each budget. And so a lot of people, once they get one or two deals, they forget about that budgeting, or they want to quit their job and they kill part of the income that is going to get them to the next deal. So not only did we keep up the budgeting, we just added in the income from every single deal and never spent that money on anything but more real estate. I did on one of ours. Another important thing is the minimum down payment on just a conventional investment loan is 15%, not 20 or 25%, like if you're buying a multifamily. So that made things a little easier for us too. I wouldn't recommend doing this now, completely different time in history, but one of ours, we did a $20,000 HELOC. It, you know, it was a $150,000 property and on our primary home. I don't recommend, I mean, $20,000 is not a big deal, but I see people all the time doing like $300,000 HELOCs, and I don't think that's a good idea. But we did do a HELOC, and for the second one, paid that back as quickly as we could, which I think was less than a year. Third one, we'd happen to have saved up enough from those other two that we could make that down payment. And then on the last two, we did have a partner, a friend of ours who owned a bunch of short-term rentals already in Siesta Key, Florida. He was really interested in getting into the Smoky Mountains, but didn't want to just jump in. So on those two, he financed them. We did all of the sweat equity work, the management, and we split everything 50-50. But as we kept building and kind of snowballing all of that savings and then income from the other properties, eventually we had him buy us out of those two, and we 1031 exchanged that into a bigger property, a bigger short term of our own.
Well, thanks for walking us through that, Avery. That's a question we get a lot from our investors is like, yeah, how do you scale? Okay, I ran out of down payments, as we all do at some point, and how do you get to the next level? And I think you're really just, what's that?
The answer is beans and rice for a year, right? Mm-hmm.
Beans and rice, and we call it the financial defense, and that's a lot of the saving appropriately, as well as adding offense and looking at other resources. I think you literally just walked through and hit a point on each one of the areas that we talk about with scalability. So I just want to make sure we call that out. So the first thing that you did is you started investing, right? And you got to start somewhere. You use your down payment for that based on whatever attractive loan structures there were. And then you minimize your expenses, which helped with the DTI, but also allowed you to save up money. You also actually reinvested your money from real estate, right? You saved up your money and reinvested your cash flow, which is essential. And I think, and equity, it sounds like you reinvested your cash flow, but also tapped into your equity, which is what we talked about in utilizing resources. You utilized partnerships to help you scale over time. And then you maximized some of the tax benefits and reinvested via 1031 exchange. So all those things combined, I mean, you don't get to over 200 doors overnight, right? This takes a lot of time and work and energy and creativity. I just want to revisit your portfolio. So as it stands now, you have a massive portfolio because you got the bug and you stuck with it, which is great. Now you're teaching other people how to do it. But it sounds like the majority of your portfolio is still single family or multifamily. It's long-term rentals. You said that, right?
Yep.
Okay. So you have a strong portfolio of 15 or whatever short-term rentals, but the majority of your portfolio is still long-term rentals, and you have a mix of these. These are diversified across multiple locations and different asset classes. But a big portion of your active business is brokering and teaching people how to invest in short-term rentals. I just want to hear your philosophy a little bit about short-term rentals compared to long-term. Can we just go through and do a quick comparison of like pros and cons and why it's maybe important to have a mix of both too?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's start with COVID. So once we got to our five short terms, we were like, all right, we've got some good income coming in here. And at the time, short-term rental investing was still very early adopter phase. Everybody was telling us that's for kids and hippies, and that's not really real estate investing. And you need, like, it was still in a very naysayer phase. And we knew we wanted to have some more long terms just to diversify our portfolio. So we started buying here and there. We would throw in a long-term rental in Chattanooga, which was in between Nashville and the Smokies, sort of a little bit south. And we got up to like 20 doors there. And the thing to remember about at least our portfolio, the per door price is wildly different. So it sounds like, oh my gosh, you're really, really long-term heavy, but our average price per long-term door is like 70, 80,000. Our average price per short-term door now is up around 800,000. So when you look at it from a dollar volume, it's a little more even. But anyway, so we had the five short-terms, we had about 20 long-terms, and we were, you know, getting there with our portfolio, just, you know, chipping away. And then COVID happened, and we thought, oh crap, here is the other shoe dropping that everybody told us was going to happen with short terms. There they go. Well, at least we have our long terms to fall back on here. But what ended up happening was the opposite. The short terms boomed because everybody wanted to get out of their houses, but they didn't want to stay in hotels. So the short terms did great. And then all of a sudden we had to worry about this eviction moratorium thing. We had to worry about, oh man, are our long terms going to go down the toilet now, which they didn't. We didn't have any eviction problems. But it felt really good at the time to know whichever thing may or may not have gone down the toilet, we had the other one to fall back on. So over time, we just kept, you know, it was a lot easier. The bank account didn't notice as much when you're grabbing a $100,000 long-term rental here and there as it did when you're getting a $600,000 short-term. And then it became, okay, we're doing so many long-term deals now. There was one time that we had like 9 closings in one day that we were like, maybe we should just buy an apartment building and have one closing and do all this one time. So then we got into the apartment. So now the way things look is we've kind of got our short-term machine rolling at all times. We've got our single family long-term machine rolling at all times. And we have our multifamily machine rolling at all times. And we kind of keep an eye on all three of the markets and just kind of pick up whatever deals come along. We actually were just under contract on a short-term, but it terminated on inspection. But so we're still actively buying in, or as active as we can be the way the market is right now, in all three asset classes. But we just have kind of, I don't think there was necessarily a step-by-step repeatable process other than you kind of have to just look at what your financial picture is at each stage and say, oh, you know what, I think maybe I'm ready for this, or maybe I'm ready for that, or maybe I'm going to stick with more short terms. But I do find that with self-managing short terms, once you get to about 10, I think 10 is kind of that level of it being a lot, like too much for you to manage and kind of defeating the purpose of real estate investing in general. It's my opinion. So
the passive side of it, where you're buying yourself another job. I mean,
yeah,
I love diversifying into short-term rentals. A big portion of what I personally own is high-end short-term rentals. I actually have 6 offers out there on different short-terms right now. And it is a challenge. I want to hear about your opinion on the market right now, but it is a challenge because, and we're trying to close before end of year for tax purposes. But it's like these sellers have not realized, at least kind of in the higher end short-term space, they tend to be a seller demographic. Like, we're not looking for distressed properties. We're looking for nice properties.
Right.
That will attract quality tenants. But there are a lot of sellers that haven't realized, like, oh, we just went through a completely different lending scenario, right? And the interest rates are quite dynamic and it changes buyers' capability, but it seems like price points aren't changing very much. And that adds challenges to making deals work. And then, of course, we can talk about the COVID boom, potentially rents skyrocketed. And I'm sure this is specific to each geographic location, but we're starting to see, you know, some of that die off a little bit. And actually, there's a lot of concern out there, like, are short terms still going to be as viable as they were like during COVID? And do we still invest in them? So let's hear about a little bit about the market and your opinion, both from a like an acquisition standpoint, but also from a rental income standpoint, kind of where we're at now, state of the union, and what do you think, where are we headed over the next year or two?
So in terms, let's talk about the acquisition standpoint first. So in terms of the acquisition standpoint, you're absolutely right. That's what we're seeing with a lot of sellers. I mean, some of even our seller clients, like we've got a couple right now that bought something for $800 before COVID, and then we've got had this big run up in equity, and now they're selling for, I want to say they should be selling for about 1.5, but we've got it listed much higher than that. But they're not understanding. They're like, but it, you know, it's really not in the grand scheme of things that much more money than what we paid. But what they're not understanding is they paid $800 at 3% interest. Now we're at 8% interest. So just the carrying costs, they're only looking at what their mortgage is and what they make on it. They're like, it makes $150,000 a year. Like, they should totally be able to afford 1.5. But the mortgage difference is like, you know, they've got a $3,500 mortgage and it would be $15,000 a month for a new buyer to come in. So even though the price doesn't seem that outrageous for how much money it makes, that interest rate really does cut in a lot. So a lot of sellers aren't really understanding how much it's costing a buyer in a monthly payment to buy something that the purchase price might not seem that outrageous. And then we're also, we have a very short inventory. So there's not a lot of inventory for that same reason, because a lot of sellers aren't listing right now, because what do sellers do? They become buyers after they sell their property. So because buyers aren't buying much right now because of the interest rates, but sellers aren't listing right now because they're going to become buyers that don't want to buy because of the interest rate. So everybody's just kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop and see what happens. So we have very, very low inventory, which is what's keeping those prices higher, because we would need an oversupply for things to start going down, but we don't have that yet. So
what do you recommend? Before we talk about the rental income aspect, what would you recommend to someone that's in the market trying to acquire property right now, specifically whether it's short or long term, just with the current, you know, where the market's at? What would your advice be to buyers right now?
There's a few things you can do. Depending on if you're getting conventional or commercial financing, you can always negotiate for the seller to cover part of your closing costs on conventional, which you could then use instead of actually paying your closing costs with that, use it to buy down your rate. There's only so much you can buy it down, but that does help you with your monthly payment amount to increase that cash flow. In terms of getting deals too, getting better deals, I would say, you know, just make offers on a lot of things, because just like we talked about the type of seller that doesn't really need to sell, that doesn't understand how much more expensive it is for buyers right now, there are a lot of people that got into the short-term rental business in the last 2 years that don't really need to be there. So people that don't look at it as the business that it is, that just said, oh man, the payment is what on a beach house? I can do that. I'll buy a beach house for me, and then I can put it on Airbnb or Vrbo and make money on it too. But then they're not treating it like that business. They're still treating it like a boat, like a toy, and they're losing money. And then they're like, oh crap, I'm losing money. And then they go to sell it. So you want to make enough offers to where you can eventually maybe find that person who does need to sell. And just, I think the biggest mistake that I see with our buyers right now is they kind of have a little PTSD from the past 2 years where you had to offer asking or over on everything. So they just, you know, swipe left on everything and say, oh, the numbers don't work at that. Well, make the offer at the number that works for you. You never know. That seller could have gotten 10 low offers already and said, no, no, no. And then on that 11th one, straw finally breaks the camel's back and they say, fine, I guess I'm just going to sell it for this. And they sell it to you for the low one. So you just don't know. Just make those offers.
Put those offers out there. Yeah. All right. And maybe share, I couldn't agree more, by the way, is like, got to put the ball in play, right? It's a numbers game. But what about rental income? Kind of a concern or hysteria that we see a little bit right now is, well, COVID, we had this crazy boom on rental income where people could acquire properties that did really well. Like, specifically with ours, which is Colorado, we've actually seen about a 20% decrease in income from where we were 2 years ago. They're still performing well, but you know, there could also be some people that are sellers in that scenario, right? Like now their income is actually less. But what's your opinion on that?
So for us, I can only really speak for the markets that we have chosen to operate in, that we really stick to regional drivable vacation destinations. So like we're in the Smoky Mountains in Tennessee, Blue Ridge, Georgia, the Panhandle of Florida. So, and these are all areas that have been vacation towns forever. So not a lot of hotels. You don't see a lot of anti-short-term rental regulations in these areas because there's not like, you know, you guys in Colorado, you have these giant corporations who own these ski slopes, who have a lot of accommodations on the ski slopes to lobby against you. So we kind of focus on areas that don't have that, with some exceptions. We've got a couple, like Disney, for example. So these are areas that let me back up a little bit too. I think a lot of areas that are seeing the income decrease are like small to large metro areas in general, where people are like, oh, you know what? Let me just convert this 10 unit apartment building I have from long-term to short-term and see if I can make more money. And then there's a lot of primary homeowners in these markets, usually a lot of hotels in these markets. Those two things make for anti-short-term rental regulations. Because, I mean, I'm very pro short-term rental, and I live in a short-term rental vacation market, but I still don't want one next door to me. You know, I'm trying to raise kids. I don't want people in and out. So I get it. So that's why we try to focus on markets where it's the norm, always has been the norm. The economy is dependent on it. So that we didn't see as much of that boom. So for example, my first two doors in the Smokies, we were making $45,000 a year. And according to AirDNA, which is really the only data trackable that we have, there were 800 rentals in the Smokies. And there were more than that. They just weren't trackable because they weren't on Airbnb or Vrbo yet. They were on these local management websites. So back then we were making $45,000 a year. According to AirDNA now, there's 8,000, but we're making $80,000 a year. So we're still over double, and we're well past, you know, the up and down curve of the COVID thing. So I think if you focus on markets like that, you are insulated. You're not protected 100%, but you are a little more insulated from those ups and downs. Whereas if you're buying something in just like a metro market where short-term rentals are a new thing, as of the past 4 or 5 years. Like Nashville, for example, up until 10 years ago, all the tourism that went to Nashville stayed in hotels. Then people started investing in short-term rentals. Then you get this big boom. And then now there's all these like there's all this friction. So we focus on areas where you don't really have to deal with that as much. And because of that, if you manage well, and if you bought right and ran your numbers right, you kind of don't see that as much as other areas.
So when that last sentence you just said there, because I was about to ask you about management, and then you said that last sentence and you said, if you manage well. So a couple of things, how do you properly manage a short-term rental? And whenever you got to, you said about 10 became the point where every time you added one, it kind of took away and added more to your plate than was worth it. How did you come to realize? Because for some people that might be 5, for other people might be 15. So what was the point where you realized, okay, this is too much. 10 was my number, and 11, 12, 13, 14, I'm going to have to go ahead. And I'm assuming then you found a property management just for those, or did you put others in there? So talk a little bit about the management side of things.
Yeah. So we still self-manage, have always self-managed our 8 short terms. We have our long terms on property managers because that's an entirely different thing. I think people think, oh, short terms is going to be so much more work. Why would you not have a manager on your short terms, but you have one on your long terms? Aren't those less work? Well, the answer to that is no. The long terms, you have to actually show people the units. You have to do background checks. You have to check their employment. You have to do all these things. Whereas the short terms, a lot of that stuff is just kind of done for you on the OTAs like Airbnb and Vrbo. You don't have to get all of their credit card information. That is done for you. It's really just managing your pricing and managing your guests and then managing your system. So all of that is stuff that can easily be done from your phone, but it's not necessarily the management of the property itself that becomes a little like voluminous. It's more of the managing the guests, because it becomes a lot more communication, and it goes from, 10 text messages a week to 100 text messages a week, which can start to, be a lot. So what a lot of us do is we have VAs to help with that. But we just kind of got to the point where we're like, our cash flow is where it needs to be. Maybe we'll buy another one like as a lifestyle asset. Like my husband really wants to own something in Wyoming, and then we can, buy something that is for us that we will rent out when we're not there. But, we're not doing that just yet. So I think that 10 mark is where you kind of have to decide, okay, am I diversifying into other types of things, or am I going to run 1,000 short-term rentals? Because that's a big job to have a lot of short-terms.
And that can make the difference too. We have property management on, which is actually a business partner of mine on the short-term rental, but they handle all of that. So management, I mean, your point is that it can be done. It probably comes down to systems and processes, just like with anything, but you're running a business when you're running short-term rentals. Just, I would argue same thing with long-term rentals. But what would your advice be for someone that is looking to get into a short-term, that has historically done long-term, or is maybe even new to real estate? They like the idea of short term, maybe they even like the idea of potentially using it. I mean, sometimes they fall into that trap, right, of like the emotional attachment instead of like it fogs the numbers and analytics for them. But like, what are some things that you would recommend to someone that's looking to get started in short term rentals? And what are some also things that you would caution them on to look out for to not make a bad investment?
So I don't think it's a good idea if you've got a portfolio of long terms to just start converting everything or converting anything to see how it goes. Like if those are doing what they need to do now, you've already figured that system out. Just let them go. Don't mess with it. Just let them do what you've got built them to do. In terms of buying, I really, really like to focus, like I said, on those regional drivable vacation destinations that don't have a lot of hotel presence, which can be different in different regions of the United States. So a lot of our offices are in like the Southeast, but we do have one in Scottsdale. But if you're in California, maybe that's Big Bear, or maybe that's Joshua Tree, these areas that, and if you don't want to like, if you're in Washington State and you don't want to go invest in Florida to do this, think of the areas that people in your metro area go for the weekend and start there. But I would make sure before you do anything, you check, call the county or call the city, not your agent, not people on Facebook in a Facebook group, to find out exactly what the regulations are so you don't make any major mistakes. Like Colorado, for example, is a really big one. I would love to. I actually looked at stuff in Colorado recently, but it's just so hard to follow all the rules to the are the places that it's allowed. And in some counties, it has to be over an acre to be allowed. And it's just all these things. So you really want to make sure that you understand that before you buy.
Yeah. I mean, the regulations are huge. I mean, we tend to recommend, because we do sell some turnkey short-term rentals. One of the best opportunities we have now is in New Brunswick, Texas. We actually have the short-term, like we have the last remaining sanctioned short-term rental lots available in that area. But our recommendation to people is always going to areas that already have regulation in place. So you know, and sometimes you don't want to be gambling where there is no regulation, where things could potentially change. You could be grandfathered in, but you could also not be. Colorado is a hard place. Like Breckenridge, for example, just shut down as of late, the past couple of years, shut down all short-term licensing in all, except for like one small resort area, right? And then so, but there's that also brings up new opportunity. Like we invest outside of Breckenridge in Blue River in some areas that are real close to it. But regulations are huge. I mean, what are you kind of work with people across the country in different areas for short-term rentals and help broker those deals. But like, throw us out your top three favorite markets for short-term rentals right now.
Right now, my favorites are, and right now my favorites are cheaper markets, because that 8% interest bites a little less on a $300,000 property than it does on a $1 million property. So Branson, Missouri, really great market. Where else? Western North Carolina is great. We have some great agents there. Shenandoah, Virginia. These are all areas where you can get something easily under 250. So I think the people over the past few years have been conditioned to think you have to go spend $1 million to get a nice short-term rental. Not necessarily the case. You can. There are, you know, deals out there for that in the Smoky Mountains or in the Panhandle of Florida, where I am. Panama City Beach is another great one to get affordable condos. So I think I like those cheaper markets right now if you're financing, just because, like I said, interest rates stings a little less there. And the Hill Country of Texas is also great, where New Braunfels is, that you mentioned. We've got agents there. I really like to have something in the Hill Country, selfishly, because I went to UT and it's very nostalgic for me, but hasn't happened yet. But those, I think those are my top few right now.
What's your general buy box for short-term rentals? Like, what kind of, are you looking at, you know, the returns that it's doing today? Are you factoring in, I think I can tweak this and get more? But so kind of, what's your buy box for whenever you're looking at a property?
So that's a really good question. So it's changed over the years. So back in 2015, before this was a really established asset class, you could find stuff out there that you would have like a 100% cash on cash return. But now that it's an established asset class, I liken it to buying an apartment building. So you're not going to find any apartment buildings that have like an amazing cap rate just laying around on the MLS turnkey ready to go. So you're looking, when you're buying a multifamily, you're looking for the opportunity. So you want something that hasn't been updated yet, that as people move out, you can update the units, raise the rent, which will then raise the cap rate. Same thing now with short-term rentals, except it's cash on cash return because it's residential and not commercial. So I don't really care myself. I'm not telling anyone else listening not to care, but I don't care what someone is making on it now. I care what the potential is. So can I add another bedroom? Can I, if I update the decor, is that going to increase the income? So I'm looking more for, just like with long-term, what the opportunity is, more so than how it's performing right this second.
Yeah, seeing that opportunity and how you can increase the performance is huge. I would add to that, one thing that we see too is that it's not always about converting, you know, a property. There's a lot of national managerial companies that just do a terrible job at managing on these properties. Mm-hmm. They have bad reviews. And so it could be as simple as coming into a property and looking at what their current income is and saying like, oh, they're, and this would be true of all asset classes. It's like under managing assets, right? But especially in the short-term space, like we bought a lot of stuff that were just mismanaged and able to increase the income by, you know, 30 or 40% within a year or two, simply by offering better, you know, service to the clients, better marketing photos and things like that without actually updating the property too much. So management can go a long way. And especially if you're personally managing, I mean, that allows you to carve out, you know, some income. I think there's a lot of opportunity there. Avery, do you ever see people doing, I mean, this is one thing we get asked a lot about on the tax side, is people trying to do, like, especially if they're self-managing, material participating, taking some accelerated depreciation on their short-term rentals. Do you work with investors on that at all? Do you have any recommendations on like how to maximize tax benefits with short-term rentals? Or,
oh yes, every day. I am a cost-seg buyer myself, which is why I just fell out of contract. So again, I'm not a CPA. This is not tax advice. Ask your CPAs. But short-term rentals and the short-term rental loophole does present a pretty good opportunity in terms of material participation to be able to cost-seg if you are not necessarily a real estate professional status. In my opinion, you kind of do have to self-manage it in order to be able to do that, because in order to qualify, you do have to have more hours. There's several different like boxes that you have to check, but one of the biggest ones is you have to have spent more time on it than any other person. And if you have a property manager, that's going to be really, really difficult to prove. So self-managing a short-term rental is a good way to, again, ask your CPA. This is just my experience as a real estate agent. I'm just an agent. But it can be a really good way to get those material participation hours that you're looking for.
Yeah, just to clarify for the audience, what Avery's talking about is like, if you're not qualifying as a real estate professional and you're still looking to take accelerated depreciation on a property to offset income, then with short term, there's this, I hate the term loophole, but I mean, it's allowed at the IRS where you can actually, material participate and own short-term rentals and take that accelerated depreciation without being a real estate professional. But it is a lot of work. You can't just qualify for it. Like, you have to put in the hour. You got to document that. If you are a real estate pro, then, I mean, that's a different story. The other thing a lot of people don't know is just with how depreciation works with short-term rentals. And in a lot of cases, depreciation may be considered as commercial at a 39-year depreciation schedule instead of 27 and a half years. If, depending on occupancy, talk with your CPA, everything, but a lot of times the IRS looks at it more as a business or like a commercial property. You're in the hospitality business. So that's something to be aware of as well. We recently, just a nugget of knowledge for people, we recently learned interviewing Brandon Hall, which Adam put in the show notes, one of our recommended real estate CPAs, that also with short-term rentals, you can be creative. It's all about like with the material participation and with accelerated depreciation, it's all about the year that the property was put into service. And so you can hire out property management in the future years, if you spend one dedicated year, again, consult with your CPA. But I mean, there's things that you can do if you just know how to do them. We have some people that buy properties, operate them personally as a short-term rental without management the first year. Then maybe year two or three, they decide that they want to bring on management. That's completely acceptable. So lots of cool stuff. Avery, this has been really exceptional. I think let's talk about your business. You have a book. Or probably multiple books. Let's give a throw out for some of those. So can you tell us about some stuff that you're working with on investors, how you work with investors, and any books we need to be aware of?
Yeah. So my book that's back there, Short-Term Rental, Long-Term Wealth. It is just a very basic walkthrough of how to identify markets, how to identify a property, how to analyze. And then it goes all the way, through the process of how to manage and how to manage your cash flow once you get there. So That's the book. I've got a podcast called The Short-Term Show, which is like short-term rental investor success stories. And then my husband has one called The Short-Term Rental Management Show, which is more of the technical aspects of management. And the short-term shop operates in 20 markets. So anybody who wants to buy a short-term rental in any of our 20 markets, if you work with one of our agents, we will teach you how to manage it. We've got a whole end-to-end training program to teach you how to manage it for free, so you can spend your money on the property rather than on a course to do something with it. And we do that all while you're under contract. So by the time closing date rolls around, you're not floundering around out there wondering what you're about to do with your $500,000 investment. We've got you trained up and you're ready to go at closing.
So talk a little bit about that before we wrap up, about building out the team, because managing long-term rentals personally, I can kind of see that, but whenever you're having to build out the team to go in there constantly for the turnover and all of the things you need in case of emergency, because if you have a short-term rental and something goes wrong, it needs to be fixed before the next guest comes. It's kind of a has to be done. Long-term rental, you might have a little more grace from the tenant depending on how it's going. But how did you successfully build out a team in a place that you're not living in?
So the best place to start, you have two core people that you need: your cleaner and a maintenance person. The cleaner being the most important. Once you find them, you can kind of build out the rest of your team from there. And I mean, it's pretty easy to find them nowadays, depending on what market that you're in. I think a lot of people mistakenly think like, oh, I'm going to go trailblaze and go be the first short-term rental in this one market. And that's great. It's going to be really, really hard to find the people that you need, though, in a market that doesn't have that infrastructure. So local to the market that you're in, Facebook groups. Sometimes there's short-term rental specific real estate investing Facebook groups in that market. But when you go in there and ask for recommendations, make sure that you ask the person recommending, hey, has this person cleaned for you before? Or if they're recommending an agent, hey, have you done a deal with them before? Because you don't want to be taking recommendations from somebody who's just like recommending their cousin because they're their cousin. You know, you want to make sure it's an actual investor. So that's a great place to start. Your agent should have recommendations for these people. So you should be able to at least be able to source between your agent and the internet a few candidates to interview, and then you can kind of build out from there.
All right. Fantastic. Well, Avery, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it. I know short terms are something like Zach said, we've only got a few in there, and it's just, you know, something that a lot of people are looking at that, you know, like you said, it's a little bit more established now, but there's still opportunities out there. So you can go check her out at theshorttermshop.com. That's theshorttermshop.com. If you want to check out the properties in New Braunfels, like Zach was talking about, or see what else we have to offer, you can head on over to renttoretirement.com. That's renttoretirement.com. We have all of our properties there. You can see, you know, Avery was talking about educating you about managing your short-term rental. We have our new Rent to Retirement Academy, where you can learn all about real estate investing and a little bit more of those tax strategies that Zach was talking about and he loves to talk about on most of our episodes. So that's at renttoretirement.com. You can see the academy. And of course, if you have any questions you want us to answer on future episodes, email us podcasts@renttoretirement.com. That's podcasts@renttoretirement.com. Really appreciate the time you spent educating yourselves today. We'll talk to you on the next episode.